What are we going to do today? Suggestions. Oh, no, I'm, that's my job. I know. Actually, we do that from time to time. We have what we call conversations on Sunday morning where I just kind of sit down there in the hot seat and we just, you know, just open it up. And how does that sound to you? Would you like to do that again sometime? We just got questions? Okay, we'll do that. And, you know, it's not that I've got an answer for everything. In fact, I firmly believe that in this spiritual journey and in Jesus' kingdom, we don't go from answer to answer. We really go from question to question, from question to more pertinent and insightful question. And so that's the key. But sometimes when we talk about things, what it does is it opens up, you know, cracks in the curtains and between the slats in the walls, where we can start to see another there out there that we can go for and we can start to work toward. And so, you know, the concepts and the things that we talk about are useful, but only in as much as we actually put them into some kind of practice in our lives right thereafter. It's got to be what we do. And that leads me right into what I wanted to talk about this morning. Last weekend, last Sunday, I tried to give what was kind of an overview of the method behind the madness of the teaching here at The Effect. You know, what we believe, why we believe it, and what are the main points that really anchor the way that we perceive Jesus, the way that we understand that he's leading us in our lives. And I went through a lot in about 45 minutes. And I was talking to someone afterwards who was in this very room and will remain nameless. And I asked him, what is it that you would have liked to have heard more about? What is it you would like to have maybe gone through a little deeper? And he was saying, you know, this thing about love, that you can't sneak up on it. You can't just inch your way up to it logically and safely. You have to take this leap. What was that all about? What's that leap about? You know? And I thought, that's excellent. That is exactly where I'd hoped that maybe there was a lack in what happened last Sunday. Because we had so much ground to cover. There were so many concepts trying to get across that we didn't have time to really dig in. And when I make a statement like that, that God's love is absolutely perfect, God's love is absolutely absolute, that it's infinite. So there is no way with a finite mind, with finite theology, with finite doctrine and tools, that we can inch our way up to it and get all the way up to the infinite. Because as soon as things go to infinity, everything that is physical, everything that is finite just melts on the dashboard before we can actually get there. So there is this gap, there is this leap that we need to take if we're really going to fall into the absolute, fall into the infinitude of God's love. There's no other way to do this. But what does that look like? What is it about? If we can't tie it down, if we can't make it concrete in our own lives, then it just kind of floats out there like planes over O'Hare. They never come in for a landing in the winter. Believe me, I know. You know, and our theology does that. Our thoughts do that. Our spiritual life does that. If it doesn't come in for a landing and take root in concrete actions, nothing changes. We can't really go where Jesus is trying to take us. You know, and here's the thing. We all talk about grace, don't we? We all talk about the fact that we're saved by grace. Paul writes it in Ephesians 2:8. Let's just take a look at that real quickly. Because there are some statements in the Bible that are so explicit. They are just so big. You know, they are so complete. It boggles the mind that we can move past them and go into other concepts or go into other types of behavior. And this is one of those two verses, Ephesians 2:8 and 9. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one may boast. Now, what part of that don't we understand? It is so explicit. It is so firm. It is so clear. But we need to know what the words mean. Grace. We use that all the time. What's it really talking about there? What's Paul talking about there? Now, Jesus doesn't use that word. Paul does. What does it mean? It means that perfect love of the Father. It means that infinite, unbounded, never withheld love that is our Father God. Not what he does, but who he is. He is that absolute infinite love. That's the grace. That grace through faith. But faith in the Bible is different than what we typically think of faith. We think of faith as something we think. We think of faith as something that we believe with our minds, that our minds agree to accept, assent to. That creed that we agree with. This is who Jesus is. This is who, what he looks like. He's the second person in the Trinity. He's this, he's this. We believe that. But in the Bible, to the Hebrews, faith had nothing to do with what you think. It had everything to do with what you do. The best synonym for faith in the Old Testament in Hebrew is steadfastness. It's living your life as if this thing you say you believe were true. No matter what doubts you have, no matter what challenges come your way, no matter what's going on, you keep living, you keep moving in that direction as if this thing were true. If you do that, you're faithful, you're steadfast, you persevere. The action was the proof of the faith. That's why James says that faith without works is dead. Not that you do the things to prove the faith, but when you have it, you can't help moving in that direction. But both in Hebrew and in Greek, there's another word, another concept that this, whether you see belief or see faith in the Old or New Testament, it is never separated from the idea of trust. Because when we persevere, when we move down this road as if something is true, if it is, it gets proven to us. And the experience of that trustworthiness becomes trust in our lives, which means our fear subsides, our anxiety subsides, all the things we worry about and think about subside in the face of this trust. So what Paul is really saying is that through trust in perfect love, we are saved. Now, what about saved? What does that mean to a Hebrew? Because to us, it means entrance to heaven and avoidance of hell in the next life. To a Jew, it means spiritual liberation here and now. Everything to the Jew is here and now. When God blesses you, it's here. If he curses you, it's here. Everything that they talk about is here and now. Liberated from what? Liberated from the fear that causes all the obsessive compulsive behavior that turns into dysfunction and broken relationships and all the side effects that many of you are here to try to erase in your lives. Trust in perfect love equals, creates, liberation spiritually here and now. That's what this means. We are saved by that. It's not our works that do it. It is this self-existing love. And when we experience it, when we enter into it, we understand this is the reality. This is the basis of everything that is. And it changes us from the inside out. Just showing up and experiencing that changes us. There are so many experiences in life that are so intense, so impactful, that they literally change us. When you hold your child for the first time, it changes you. And when you keep showing up to that child's life, it changes you. A person who is a parent is different from a person who is not. It's just unavoidable because of the experiences that you have over the 20 years that you get to have with your child in that sort of position. It changes you. Experiencing God's love changes you when you experience it day by day and over again. But it self-exists. It is this thing. We can't alter it in any way. And if we think that our behavior is going to alter God's love, turn it on, turn it off, cause him to withhold it or pour it out, then we've completely negated that everything with Jesus was about. Because Jesus was trying to tell us about a good news, and the good news is there's no bad news. The good news is this love exists. We can access it, and this is how we do it. And so this perfect love, this concept of the Father's love is like the holy grail of Christianity. It's the, I'm going to use a term here, sine qua non. Have you heard that one before? I don't think our resident lawyer is here. He would probably know it. It's Latin. It literally means without which none. What it really means in our concept is that it is the absolutely essential ingredient. It's the essential aspect of something, without which it doesn't exist as itself. You know? What's a cake without sugar? Sugar is the sine qua non of a cake, right? The Father's love is the sine qua non. It is the essential ingredient of the way of Jesus to the Father. If we don't get that, we don't get the way at all. We can work and work and work and work, but we're not going to go where Jesus is going. One of the things I tell people that I have the pleasure and privilege of working with over time is that I say, if there's only one thing that we can do here, if I can put that red X over the treasure on your map, then that's enough. Because then at least you won't just be digging holes anymore. The hole that you dig will actually be going to where you need to go. The X over the treasure of our maps of Jesus' way is positioned directly over the Father's love. If we're not digging for that, we're not getting where we want to go. So why is love this central? Why is love the essential ingredient? Well, let me give you an analogy that I love. Some of you have already heard it before. Pardon me. I should come up with new ones, I suppose, from time to time. Do all of you like, or how many of you like thrill rides, like roller coasters? A few of you, all right? Why do you like roller coasters? Go ahead. The rush. What do? They scare the heck out of us, don't they? We like to be scared. Why do we like to be scared? Because it's exciting. We feel alive. Why do we feel alive? Because in a tense moment, an intense experience like a thrill ride, it is so intense it blows every other thought out of our heads. And the only one left is just hanging on for dear life and experiencing the ride, right? That makes us feel good. That makes us feel alive. We love it. But although we love to be scared out of our minds, the reason we like to do it, the reason that it's pleasurable, is that we know that at the end of the ride, the car is going to come to a nice slow stop at the end, and Mom and Dad are there waiting with the cotton candy to take us home. If, for one instant, you looked out on the next loop, you saw a section of track missing, what would that do to your experience? Okay, you're still scared, but it's a different kind of scared, isn't it? Now, here's the deal. This life of ours is the greatest thrill ride ever invented. God created this thrill ride for us called our lives. And it's scary. It moves us and shakes us, and it keeps us interested because there's always something coming at us. It's a series of things that we need to deal with and face and move through. They're equal parts pain and pleasure, and all this stuff is going on. It literally is a roller coaster. But if for one instant we think that there's a section of track missing, if for any instant we think that at the end of this ride, there's nothing for us, we just wink out of existence, or worse yet, we're not accepted, we have to go to some place called hell for the rest of eternity, if for one instant we think this is not going to turn out well, that car is not going to come to a nice stop, how in the world can we enjoy the ride of our lives? As scary as it is, it becomes terrifying. And in that terror, we need to medicate. We need something to take away the edge. And we find it in all of the dysfunctional ways that we find ways to get through the terror of life. If we don't trust that love is absolute, that we can't lose it, that if we just turn to it and face it, it's ours. If we don't know that, if we think we haven't done enough, if we think we haven't been good enough, if we think we haven't been talented enough, or any of the things that we tell ourselves in our heads, then there's a section of track missing in our lives. And we will fear so deeply that we can't go where Jesus goes. We can't do it. We cannot have the freedom, the spiritual liberation here and now to be able to live as Jesus lived, the other-centered life, the completely vulnerable and open life that he lived, that he's calling us toward. We can't do it. The fear is too great. That's why this love is the sine qua non of our way to the Father, Jesus' way to the Father. This trust is key. It has to be about the trust. We have to get to that place. And that's what we're talking about here. All right, so if I say it so strongly as that, if I say we're already accepted, if I say that our behavior has nothing to do with God's love, then am I saying that there is no hell? Am I saying that everything is universally reconciled to God? No, that's not what I'm saying at all. There's a parable that was told contemporaneously with Jesus ministry comes from the first century, either B.C. or A.D., but it's not in the Bible. It's called the King's Parable. It was a type of parables that Jesus told, you know, about the king and the wedding feast and all. This is another one that is non-canonical, but it makes a great point, and it illustrates what Jews believed about the afterlife and about these issues. A king has a great feast, and he calls people to the feast, and he tells them, bring whatever you want to recline on, because they didn't sit in chairs in the ancient East. They lied on cushions or couches on their left side and then ate with their right hands. Everything was finger food in those days, and bowls and dipping and that sort of thing. So he says, bring whatever you want to lie on. And so some bring cushions and couches, and some bring pillows. Others bring logs and stones. And they all come into the hall, and he says, okay, go ahead and recline on whatever you brought. Now, the ones who bring logs and stones are disgruntled. They're murmuring against the king. Why? What an insult would he have us in his very home lie on this way? And the king hears him, and he says, what are you talking about? You brought these things. You disgraced my home with these things. So you lie on what you brought. C.S. Lewis says that the gates of hell are locked from the inside. However you want to picture this thing, the point is, I'm not saying there is no hell. I'm saying God doesn't put us there. The Jews are saying God doesn't put us there. That was their understanding. We put ourselves there. We create the conditions under which we live, this life and the next one, I believe. There's another story in Hebrew folklore that in the Olam Haba, which is the world to come, everybody goes to the same place, both the righteous and the unrighteous alike. They end up in the same place, and they're interacting with each other. But nobody's arms bend at the elbow. So your arms are stiff. So if you're in hell, you're starving to death because you can't feed yourself. You can't bend at the elbow, right? If you're in heaven, it's because you've learned to feed each other. The idea is that heaven and hell are states of being, depending on if we have been able to experience this love of the Father, if we've been able to bring it into ourselves and make it a part of who we are so that it permeates and it creates the reality of heaven, not just in the next life, but here and now. That's what kingdom is, this quality of life here and now. That's why Jesus' way is the only way to the Father. He said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. What way? The way, truth, and life are a person. They're not a thing. We misunderstand. When we approach the person, when we become one with the person, we are following the way of Jesus. And we have the experiences that dissipate the fear that allow us the liberation to live this life as Jesus was trying to get us to live it. This way of Jesus is the way to that experiential leap. That place where we get up as far as we can go and we just have to fall. We can't sneak up on it. It just has to fall. You know, the first followers of Jesus understood this intimately. Do y'all know what the first followers of Jesus called themselves? Often we think they call themselves Christians because that's what's come down to us historically. But the first Jewish followers of Jesus, I think some of you said it, called themselves followers of the way. And notice the distinction there. They didn't even say followers of Jesus, followers of Yeshua. In Aramaic, it's Talmidi Urha, followers of the way. But the way is Jesus. But it emphasizes the oneness with Jesus. It emphasizes living as Jesus lived and relating as he related and loving as he loved. Just as he said, I give you one commandment at the Last Supper in John. Love each other as I have loved you. Do that. If you love me, follow my commandment. If you follow my commandment, you're my followers, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. All of these things are interconnected. Followers of the way. Did you know that the cross wasn't a symbol of Christianity for about 300 years? Really, it was under Constantine in the 4th century that it really became a universal symbol of Christianity. Prior to that, especially in those first generations after Jesus, it wasn't a symbol of death that they gathered under, it was symbols of life. The fish, the ichthus, the anchor, concentric circles that represented Father and Son in eternal oneness. It was a different shift. It was an active way of living life, that took us into the experience, got us to that precipice, that point where we leapt off into the Father's love. That Pentecost moment where finally the apostles, having exhausted every other way, finally took that leap in that windy room that they were in and found a power and a connection that they had never known before. Even though they knew that Jesus lived, they still hadn't taken that leap until that moment. And then their ministries began. It's like this. It's like this. Last week, we talked about a couple of desert fathers. One of them was Amanas, who was said to have advanced in his silence, in his contemplation, in his walk, to the point that he took no notice of wickedness. And we talked about how that's such a jarring expression for those of us here in the modern West, that he took no notice of wickedness. And the story goes that a young woman who was pregnant out of wedlock is brought to him for punishment and penance, and he won't punish her. In fact, he orders that 6 pairs of fine linen be given to her for the childbirth. And everybody's outraged. Give her a penance. Come on. He won't do it. What am I to do, brethren? He says. She could be near to death. These are the things that she needs. Takes no notice of wickedness. And we talked about how seemingly immoral, unethical, and unjust that is. But these things of our faith are not theoretical. They have real world consequences, real human consequences. And I'll tell you right now, as a pastor doing this as long as I've done it, I have come into so many circumstances and had so many questions and had people come to me that have tested my ability to take no notice of wickedness, you know, to do this that we're talking about. I've had several fathers come to me and tell me that they just found out that their sons had come out as being gay to them, and they didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to react. They didn't know how to deal with the situation. That's a real situation. That's real human angst. That is a real grinding against the seeming rigid law and morality that we say is our faith and the real hurting human being that's in front of you. I've had gays come to me and ask me, how can they be a part of the church? How does this work? Can they be a part of the church? The church seems to be saying one thing. Can they be a part of it as well? How would you answer? What would you say? I've had women come to me like this one. Pregnant out of wedlock, don't know what to do, don't know where to turn, don't know what to believe. Maybe they've been ostracized by family or friends, by church. I've had others, male and female, come to me and say that they want to move in with their boyfriend or girlfriend. What does the church think about that? What do I think about that? What would you say? What would you do? People come to me with drug problems. People come to me that have had all sorts of criminal offenses. If I can't get to the point where I can take no notice of wickedness, if I can't get to the point that I can see past this behavior, these deeds, these things, no matter what I think about them personally, if I can't get past them, how can I be helpful? How can I exhibit this love? If all I have learned to do in my life is obey rules, obey law, what good am I? When people come with the very real human problems that occur in life. Can't wish it away. Can't say it should be this way. It is this way. And what's our job? To love each other as I have loved you. Can we take that next step? Can we move beyond? Okay, well then you say, well, what about sin? What about repentance? What about that? Aren't we supposed to be dealing with that? Aren't we supposed to be doing something about that? Aren't you as a pastor supposed to be preaching that? You know, that's the other side of Jesus' message, isn't it? That we're supposed to do both? Well, the idea here is that the law, obedience, ethics, morality, all of those things are included in love. They're not mutually exclusive. You want to hear me say it? Okay. Don't sin. Okay? Follow the law. Let it never be said I didn't say that from the pulpit, because don't sin. Absolutely. Jesus said it too. He accepted someone like the woman who was caught in adultery. You know, where are your accusers? Well, there's no one here, Lord. Well, neither do I accuse you. but go and sin no more. And let's talk about what sin is. Sin is not the behavior. Sin is the state of separation. Sin is missing the mark from the unity, the perfect unity, connection, acceptance, and love that is God. Anything less than that is sin. Any behavior that leads to separation, leads to less than unity, is sinful. But it's not the behavior itself. So go and stop doing the things that separate you. Go and stop doing the things that create less than unity in your lives and in your relationships. Stop doing those things. But in the next breath, let's realize that mere obedience teaches us nothing about love. I'm sorry, but it doesn't. All it teaches us is to fear the punishment. If all we're going to do is obey, we will never learn about love. But we need to start with obedience, don't we? Just like a 2-year-old, don't cross the street without looking. Don't put your hand on the stove. We don't explain why, just don't do it. All we got to do is keep the toddler alive long enough to be able to explain to them, right, what we want them to do. It's the same with us. We got to stay alive long enough, try to do no lasting damage enough that we can get these things and start to understand the concepts. But if we don't graduate from mere obedience to an understanding of what it is we're after, if we continue to try to live our lives as a negative, always taking out the things we don't want, thou shalt not, all we do is create a vacuum that sucks the next thing in. What Jesus is talking about with seeking first kingdom and God's righteousness and all else will be added is that we are putting into ourselves the things of God. We are putting into ourselves the resonance with the king's values, with God's values, with his pleasure, with his will, so that they become ours. And it displaces the things we don't want. Jesus is telling us to live our lives as a positive, not a negative. Okay, we start out with a negative. Just do what you're told for a while. But start to learn what it is that Jesus is telling us so that we can turn that around and bring into our lives the things that we do want. Start to get a sense of what this love is all about. Because without that, we'll never get to go where Jesus is trying to take us. So mere obedience puts us in the camp of love. But we have to take that leap at some point. If we never take the leap, we are always on the hamster wheel, always trying to be good enough, always trying to do exactly what Ephesians 2 tells us cannot be done. We can't do this by works. We can't boast about it and say, yes, I did this. I'm good enough now. God must accept me because I passed the bar. It doesn't work that way. It's a gift that we can't give ourselves. Trying to get that. So, how do we take this leap? Because I want to try to get explicit here. I want to get specific here. How do we take this leap? How do we do this? What are some concrete things that we can do? Take a look at your handouts are up on the screen because I think TJ's got it up there. I got 5 points here. And as I look at the way that Jesus is giving us, the way he lays it out in the New Testament, when I look at the 12 steps, since we're using that constantly in here as a recovery ministry, when I look at my life, when I look at the lives of others, when I have gotten enough evidence here to kind of see what works and what doesn't, you know, over time, these are the things that stand out to me in this particular order. And it's really what Jesus is talking about as well. The first one, this leap into perfect love, is preceded by a way of living life that will take us right up to the precipice. These 5 things will guide us there. They will prepare the ground. They will get us ready to get right up to the edge. And then we have a choice to make. And the first one is meditation or centering prayer. Centering prayer is a 20th century adaptation of the ancient Christian practice of silent prayer of rest. It's called hesychastic prayer in the Greek, but it just means a wordless prayer. It just means resting, a contemplative resting in God. Meditation is like that. You know, the Jews' Bible is organized differently than ours. They call it the Tanakh, and that really is a acronym. And the letters are T-N-K, R-T-N-K. They're Tav and Nun and Kuf. But in their language, it stands for Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, which means the law, the prophets, and the writings. And the law is all about this understanding of the way that we operate in God's kingdom. First 5 books of the Bible, written by Moses traditionally. The second group of books is called the prophets. And it incorporates the major and minor prophets and other writings that we don't consider prophetic literature. In fact, the first book is Joshua. You know what Joshua opens with in verse 8? It's meditate on the Torah day and night. And then the first book of the third, the writings section, is the Psalms. And what does Psalm 1 say? Meditate on the Torah day and night. It's all written throughout. It was reminded to the Jews throughout that this idea of meditation, this idea of connection was so important. And in ancient life, we have to understand how different it was in our lives. They were an agrarian society. They worked while the sun was up. But when the sun went down, there was no TV. There was no artificial lights other than candlelight or lamps. They took a noon break, a big long siesta right in the middle of the day when the sun was at the hottest. The tempo of life was so much slower. There were big chunks of time with nothing to do, which they could use to meditate. They could use to reconnect. They could use to do what we were trying to do this morning in the worship. But where we only get a half an hour a week maybe to do something like that, they had hours each day. It was a different kind of life. And so we live lives that are so out of balance, so out of kilter with that. We need to take the time to be silent with our God. We need to take the time to just be aware. And if we can put into our lives a regular practice, 20 to 30 minutes each morning or each evening, or if you can do it twice a day, where you just go into that place, that devotional space, and you can do it any way you want to. You know, if you're Catholic, you can say the rosary. If you say it right, let that just take your brain off into another land, and then you can sit there and just be present. But devotional reading, and then just sitting back after that and letting the words sink in. Not a study, but a devotional reading. Meditation, centering prayer, something that allows you to be quiet, prepares the ground. It is the practice that you need for presence, for mindfulness. In this type of prayer, you are teaching yourself to be present. You're teaching yourself to be mindful. You're teaching yourself to step away from all that constant barrage of noise and thoughts in your own head so that you can hear God's voice, whose native language is silence. You've got to learn to speak it if we're really going to connect with Him. And so this regular practice, if you can put it into your life, is giving you the tools so that all throughout your day you can do the next one, which is presence and mindfulness. It's not that we do the centering prayer, the meditation, as an end in itself, any more than a musician who goes into the practice room and learns scales is doing that just so he can play in the practice room. The idea is to be able to get so good at that, so under your fingertips that you don't have to think about it. When you go on stage, you can play under any circumstances. We need to get good enough at learning to become present to God that we can take that into all the moments of our lives. The moments when we're really being triggered. The moments when our emotions are spiking. The moments when we are really afraid that we're not going to get this all done. How in the world am I going to do this? What if I lose my job? What if I can't pay the rent? What if my child doesn't get better soon? What if? And all these things are just pounding at us. If we have taken the time to practice, we can come back to a center. We can lean into a moment and find God in the moment. And everything changes. Not the circumstances. We change within the circumstances and find that we can get through it. There is a way to overcome. And then what do we do in those moments that we become present to? When we lean into even the painful moments, don't shrink away. Because the only place we're going to get the healing that we're looking for is in that moment. Because the only place we're going to find God is in that moment. It's the only moment that exists. And this is something that we take from our recovery, relapse prevention practice. It's contrary action. Whatever you're feeling, if it's a negative emotion, it's a manifestation of fear. Whether it's jealousy or envy or guilt or shame or depression or anger, it's fear. What is that emotion telling you to do? How is it telling you to act out? What choice is it telling you to make? Pretty much, across the board, it'll be 180 degrees opposite of what you need to do in order to reconnect with the presence of God in order to make a choice that has the best effect for everyone that is in your sphere of influence at that moment. Do the opposite. What is your anger telling you to do? Drive up to the guy that cut you off and flip him off? Don't do it. Do something else. Is your depression telling you to go back to bed and close the blinds and put the cover over your head? Call in sick to work? Don't do it. Take a shower. Fix your face. Get out the door. Go to Starbucks. Get a coffee. Reconnect with humanity. Go to work. Throw yourself into your work. Contrary action. But you can only take contrary action. You can only do this if you are actually aware of and present to the moment. Otherwise, you will just do the knee-jerk stimulus response thing that you always do when you're triggered. Trigger, response, trigger, response. But if we can stop, if we can become mindful and present, if we can bring what we have learned in our prayer closet to bear, we can take that breath and we can make a different choice. And that gives us a completely different experience. We can realize that even in those painful moments when we're triggered, we can break through and we can get to a place where we realize that God is still on his throne. He still has not left us or forsaken us, and that we can, with his strength, move through. Somehow this is all going to work out. And then we need to stay undiverted in this, which means when we do screw up, when someone hurts us, perpetrates something against us, that we can take a look at that and we can enact forgiveness. And forgiveness is no more or less than freeing ourselves from the bitterness and the victimization, that sense of victimhood, letting it go. And what does that contrary action look like? Well, how hard is it for you to say you're sorry? How hard is it for you to admit that you were wrong? For some people, it just sticks right here and it just can't quite get out, you know? How hard is it for you to let bygones be bygones? To finally just let go of the anger and the resentment? You know, what's the first thing that happens when you get hurt? Or you hurt somebody else? You notice how you can't make eye contact anymore? Is that the way it is for you? Man, as soon as I'm hurt, it is so hard for me to just look in that person's eyes. I'm always darting about. Look in their eyes. Do something different. Look straight in their eyes. What is it that needs to happen in order for this relationship to come back on a par? It's gotten out of balance. What is it that you can do? If I'm the perpetrator, then I can make amends. If I'm the perpetrator, I can say I'm sorry and mean it without any justification. Yeah, I'm sorry, but no, there's no but in this kind of apology. It's like that. Forgiveness, essential. Otherwise, all of the things that we've done before will get diverted off into the gutter, someplace in the ditch. And then finally, if we do this long enough, we get to a point where we're not judging anymore because we're not seeing people as other than ourselves. We see them as deeply connected to us, deeply human. And we realize we can treat them that way as well. And the identification with each other is the love. God identifies with us. How in the world does that happen? I don't know, but he does it. He created us in such a way that he can identify with us. Jesus identified with us. I and the Father are one. You and I can be one. If you want to be one with me, I'll be one with you. Identification. You don't judge people at that point because you see them as the same as you. So important to see that. So, those are the parameters. But what does the leap actually look like? What is it we're actually doing? And you know, the interesting thing is, we think of taking this leap of faith as the big moment, right? Indiana Jones at the edge of the precipice there, and he has to take the leap to see if he can get across for the Holy Grail. But in reality, in our daily lives, it's just another moment. It's every moment. You know what a moment is? It's what's wrapped around a choice. That's really what a moment is. Every moment contains a choice. That's how you know you're in a moment. You got a choice to make. The choice is, are you going to enter into the moment or are you going to flee from it? And if we can enter into that moment, we realize that's a significant moment. Every moment is a significant moment. If we'll see it as such, if we just enter in, take the leap. And so the question you can always ask yourself if you're afraid to take the leap is, what am I afraid of? Why am I afraid? Why can't I make eye contact? Why can't I just enter in? Why am I still, even if it's emotionally, hanging at the edges of the things? You know, feeling alone in a crowded room, not allowing myself to connect. Why am I doing this? Why won't I jump? Or what if it's insecurity? Is that what you're afraid of? Not having the security that you need? And what does that cause you to do? Not to give, not to put money in the tithing basket, not to give to people that you know need it because you're afraid that maybe you won't have enough for yourself. And if that's starting to sound real self-serving for the church, you know, come on, give, give, give. Well, it goes the other way too. What if you give because you're afraid if you don't that God will withhold his blessing from you? What if you do that? Then maybe what you need to do is not give and see what happens. What are you afraid of? If you're so afraid of your insecurity, maybe you don't do the things that you would love to do. You're not willing to follow your bliss. Maybe you don't go after that degree. Maybe you don't go after that job. Maybe you don't go on Match.com and look for a date. I don't know. But what would happen if you did? What would happen if you just took that leap and tried and saw what would happen? And maybe something different than you expect will happen. And it'll change your whole perspective. What if it's shame that you're dealing with? What if you're unwilling to look foolish? I told you a few weeks ago about when I was in high school, there was a kid who was the butt of every joke. He was a homely kid. He was awkward and geeky, and his name was Abel Marmolejo. I said that before. And everyone made fun of him, and everyone ostracized him. And I was sort of, you know, one of the cool ones, I guess. I was a senior class president and this and that. But I wouldn't, even though I saw what was going on, I suppose because I didn't want to look foolish, because I didn't want to lose the respect of my quote-unquote friends, I never sat with him at cafeteria. I never engaged him in the yard. I never did the first thing to try to make him feel like he was a part of something at that school. My shame, my unwillingness to look foolish kept me from something that could have been such a gift and such a learning experience for me. Are you kidding? You know? Are we afraid to make a public confession of our faith? Are we afraid to show people what it is we really believe? My mother was converted in a charismatic way when I was in high school, and she was so obnoxious about it that I just wanted to have nothing to do with it, you know? And so all of those trappings of charismatic faith, you know, saying the sinner's prayer, giving your life to Jesus, all those things, just had this really bad taste in my mouth. And I remember the Sunday morning, years and years later, I'm sitting with my four-year-old daughter in my lap, and the pastor does an altar call. And it was so hard for me to put my hand up. But I did. I broke through and put my hand up. And I still remember my daughter looking up at me and saying, "Daddy, why are you crying?" You know. But it was hard to break through and do that. But that began a journey of the last 25 years. Can we break through the things that scare us? Do something different than we've ever done before? What if you're afraid of getting hurt? What if you're afraid of being a doormat? You know? Can you finally just stop blaming people? Can you try something different? You know? Can you dare to trust someone again? You've said, "I'll never be hurt again. I'm not going to put myself in that position again." Can you just go ahead and do it and see what happens? See if someone is worthy of that trust? Can you take that kind of leap? If it's guilt, can you make that apology without any justification? Can you just go up and lay it all out? "I was so wrong. I'm so sorry. Anything that I can do to make this right, I'm willing to do." Can you put yourself there? Can you make your amends? Can you admit that you're wrong? What if you're afraid of others that are just different from you? You walk into a situation and you see the homeless person, you hear the person who has uneducated speech, and you immediately make that judgment about them. Can you break through that? Can you go up to them and shake their hand and just say hello? Can you just treat them as if you'd treat any member of your family or anyone for whom you feel the affinity and feel the connection? Can we break through there? Each one of these is a leap. It may seem insignificant to you. It may seem like such a small thing. But what I'm telling you is that when we show up, to each one of these moments and make the choice to leap into that unknown, to move through the fears that we feel, stuff happens. It just happens. You don't even know that it's happening. You'll find out later. If we can just show up to these things, the connection we feel at those moments is significant. Sometimes we feel it, sometimes maybe we don't. But it's taking us to this place. There's a quick story. Where am I at in time? Quick story I wanted to read you. We're reading the Desert Fathers and Mothers on Tuesday night, and this one story just hit me. And it goes like this. One of the elders, one of the old monks who had been, you know, in silence and solitude and doing all the things that we're talking about right now, following the same path, one of these elders had finished his baskets, because they all had some manual labor, and had already put handles on them. When he heard his neighbor saying, "What shall I do? The market is about to begin, and I have nothing with which to make handles for my baskets." And at once the elder went in and took off his handles, gave them to the brother with these words, "Here, I don't need these. Take them and put them on your baskets." Thus, in his great charity, he saw to it that his brother's work was finished while his own remained incomplete. That's a leap. It's a leap. Past the insecurity, past the financial worry, past everything. Just make a leap in the moment and see what happens. Can we do that? I was talking to someone just a couple of days ago, and in his story that he was giving me, he says, "I just can't figure this thing out." Later in the conversation, I pointed him back to that statement and said, "That's why. Because you're trying to figure it out. It doesn't work that way. You don't figure it out. You don't sit on the couch and draw the map and get everything in your mind and then step out the door with the finished plan and knowing exactly what you're going to do. You just step out the door and start walking. And things happen. As you show up to your moments, the plan becomes clear. As you show up to your moments, the attitudes change and the trust begins. And you know that you're equal to this life. You can live it. You can do it because you're connected to your God in a way that you never expected. Jesus is pointing us to the Father's love that has no degree. It's degreeless. And that's why it always looks the same. Something that cannot be measured, that is infinite, always looks the same. They say that wherever you are in our universe, it's always going to look the same. Same star field, same equal distribution and density wherever you go, because it can't be measured. God's love can't be measured. That's why it always looks the same. That's why the love is the same for the prodigal son and the elder brother. And the elder brother is outraged that his prodigal brother, the screw-up, gets the party when he comes home without any amends even being made, without even a real good act of contrition being made. But the love is the same because it has no degree. The workers that come early in the morning and the midday and late with only an hour left and all get paid the same because this love has no degree. It looks the same. It's outraging. It's unethical. It's immoral. It's unjust. Yeah, it is all those things. Because it's perfect. Because it can't be measured. Ethics and morals and laws are mere attempts at imitating this love. And they can only go so far. And then they fall short. Because a law can't make the leap. We can make the leap into perfect love and move beyond mere law and ethics and morals, move beyond the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees into the kingdom, into the kind of life that Jesus is talking about. And so when we get to 1 John 4, another sine qua non of our faith, at verse 16, "We have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love, and the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him." Oneness, unity. "By this, love is perfected with us, so that we may have confidence in the day of judgment, because as he is, so also are we in this world, connected, one, experiencing that oneness. There is no fear in love. But perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves punishment, and the one who fears is not perfected in love. We love because he first loved us." We can't know what this means until we have walked this way and experienced what it means. will never understand any other way. That's why Jesus says, I am the way, and there is no other way to the Father. Flipping channels yesterday, came across Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, got stuck and watched it all the way to the end. What a movie that is. 1969, can you believe it's that old? But when you look at Paul Newman and Robert Redford, yeah, I guess you can believe it. They're so young, they're so perfect. But there is a scene in the movie toward the end where they have been pursued by the posse from hell. This posse just never gives up. And the running line is, who are those guys? They throw every trick in the book to lose the posse, and they're still falling. Who are those guys? Who are those guys? And then finally, they are at the edge of a cliff, looking down at probably 1,000-plus feet drop straight into a river. And they're pinned. And here comes the posse in an elevated position. I'd be able to shoot down on them. And they know that they're cornered, and they know that they're done. And they're preparing to fight, and Sundance is loading his weapon. And all of a sudden, Butch gets this flash. No, wait. We can jump. Hell, we can, Sundance says. No, it'll be all right. If the water's deep enough and we don't get squished, they'll never follow. Well, how do you know that? He says, would you make that jump if you didn't have to? I have to, and I'm not gonna, he says. And then he says, okay, I'll go first. Nope. All right, then you go first. Nope. What's the matter with you? Sundance waits a beat and just looks at him and says, I can't swim. And then Butch waits a beat and just bursts out laughing, throws his head back, and he says, are you crazy? The fall will probably kill you. It's just one of those moments that's so perfect. The fall will probably kill you. And then Sundance looks down, and you see the realization come over his face. This is a fear that he has been carrying since childhood. The fear of water. The fear of not being able to swim. And all of a sudden, he gets to this moment, right up at that moment, and realizes it doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't matter anymore. This is where my life has come. It's no longer acceptable. My life is unmanageable. I need to do something different than I've always done if I want to get a result different than I've always experienced. And they go. And if you look at the picture, that's them falling. You see, all of our fears that we face, that we have been facing all our lives, are the posse from hell chasing us. It chases us and chases, and we run and we run and we exhaust ourselves, and we keep asking, who are those guys? Why can't I lose them? Why can't I outrun them? Why can't I get where I need to go? And every moment is a moment on that precipice. Every moment is a moment that we can say yes and jump, or no, I'm going to try to keep running and fighting. But until we finally just give up, let go, and jump, we will never know whether the water is deep enough. We'll never know if God's love is deep enough to catch us. Jump. At some point, just jump. In all these little tiny ways. You don't have to do something major. You don't have to sell the farm or the family business. All you have to do is look someone in the eyes once when you thought you couldn't do it. Admit that you're wrong when you thought you couldn't do it. Do anything that you are afraid to do. Move through. Jump off. Find that the love is deep enough. And add that to your reservoir of experiences that will take you into kingdom, into the Father's love, and into the life that Jesus has for us. And then you will know that you know that this love is real, and it will change you from the inside out. Let's pray. Father, this is an amazing world that you've set up for us. It's an amazing ride. We want to enjoy it. We want not to be too scared to be able to enjoy the ride and realizing all the gifts that you've placed in our path. So help us with our unbelief. Help us with our fears. Help us to overcome one small choice point at a time to realize that your love is deep enough to catch us. We can do this. In you, we can do this. Help us to understand that that is true. Take us wherever you want us to go. Father, we give you permission to take us kicking and screaming into the place that we most fear so that we can finally leap off. And we love you because you first loved us. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.